Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, August 20th, 2001. In the fireside room this morning is Bob Ekblad. Today's session number is EKB 2001-1, and it's titled God's Call to the Marginalized, God's Call to Moses. Let's listen in.
I'm beginning a series of five Bible studies on God's call and how God calls through the particulars of certain stories, you know, narrative stories in the Old Testament. And we're starting with Moses and then going to Abraham and then Rebekah and Judah and Tamar, and then looking at ending with Pharaoh, you know, God's call of Pharaoh, which most people don't think of Pharaoh as being called. Anyway, this comes out of some reflections that I've done over the years in a course I've taught called The Grammar of Vocation, which looks at how the actual details of a text can be illustrative or teach and open our eyes really to how it is that God comes and might show up. I mean, like, how does a text provide us with clues to the way that might help us see how God shows up and calls in our own lives? And anyway, the approach I use is sort of a narrative approach more than a historical critical approach. And narrative is like basically looking at who the actors are in the story and where they are and what verbs, you know, what do they do and what don't they do, and, you know, where does God fit into all that? And basically a reading that any of us can do. And I have that approach mainly because my work for the last 20 years has been with people who are often semi-literate, actually often completely illiterate. I worked in Honduras for 6 years with peasants leading Bible studies, and 80% of the people were completely illiterate. So this approach works with folks who don't have Bibles. I mean, you can read the text over several times and, you know, and get people into the detail of the text to some extent. And more recently, the last 7 years, I work leading Bible studies with inmates in Skagit County Jail, which is a jail just 1 hour north of Seattle. And I lead two Spanish Bible studies every week in the jail. And I'm currently working on a book called Reading the Bible with the Damned. You know, reading the Bible with people that feel like they're damned. So I'm more used to reading this story with people who are dressed in red uniforms, you know, with numbers on them. And so to try to read this in a way that is compelling for all of you is going to be a lot up to you. So I invite you to participate in this process. So actually, before we do we do some reading of the text, I'd like us to begin with a prayer. Before we do that, we have some volunteer readers, and I need folks that are willing to read fairly loudly and clearly. I need four or five or six, however many we can marshal. Who would read for us chapter 1 of Exodus, verses 1 through 7? Okay. And how about chapter 1, verses 8 to 14? Thank you. Verses 15 through the end of chapter 1, 22. Okay, now chapter 2, verses 1 to 10. Okay, thank you. Let's begin with a prayer. God, I thank you that we have this privilege to gather in your name around your word. I ask that you would open our hearts and open our minds and help us to be careful observers of your scriptures, and send your Holy Spirit so that these scriptures can illuminate our own lives, so we can hear whatever word you have for each one of us. I pray this in the name of Jesus. Amen. All right, first reader, or you can just keep reading.
These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each with his household: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah; Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin; Dan and Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. The total number of people born to Jacob was 70. Joseph was already in Egypt. Then Joseph died, and all his brothers, and that whole generation. But the Israelites were fruitful and prolific. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them.
Now a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. He said to his people, "Look, the Israelite people are more numerous and more powerful than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, or they will increase, and in the event of a war, join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land." Therefore they set taskmasters over them to oppress them with forced labor. They built supply cities, Pithom and Ramesses, for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread, so that the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites. The Egyptians became ruthless in imposing tasks on the Israelites and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in every kind of field labor. They were ruthless in all the tasks that they imposed on them.
And the king of Egypt spake to the Hebrew midwives, of which the name of one was Siphrah and the name of the other Puah, and he said, "When ye do the office of the midwife to the Hebrew women, and see them upon the stools, if it be a son, then ye shall kill him, but if it be a daughter, then she shall live." But the midwives feared God, and did not as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the men children alive. And the king of Egypt called for the midwives, and said unto them, "Why have you done this thing, and why have you saved the men children alive?" And the midwives said unto Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women, for they are lively and are delivered ere the midwives come to them." Therefore God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and waxed very mightily. This is King James Version. And it came to pass, because the midwives feared God, that he made them houses. And Pharaoh charged all the people, saying, "Every son that is born ye shall cast into the river, and every daughter ye shall save alive."
Now a man from the house of Levi went and married a Levite woman. The woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was a fine baby, she hid him 3 months. When she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and plastered it with bitumen and pitch. She put the child in the basket and placed it among the reeds on the bank of the river. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. The daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river, while her attendants walked beside the river. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her maid to bring it. When she opened it, she saw the child. He was crying, and she took pity on him. "This must be one of the Hebrews' children," she said. Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and get you a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse the child for you?" Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Yes." So the girl went and called the child's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child and nurse it for me, and I will give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed it. When the child grew up, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and she took him as her son. She named him Moses, because, she said, "I drew him out of the water."
All right, thank you. So Exodus begins with the story of this one family, right, that came to Egypt as immigrants, the family of Jacob. And there's a description of how that whole generation died off. But then the people, that didn't stop this life force, you know, of the chosen people. All this language in verse 7, you know, "But the Israelites were fruitful and prolific. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, and they filled the land," right? All of that evokes Genesis chapter 1, you know, the end of chapter 1, where God tells the first human to be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth, okay, and subdue it. So here we're shown right from the beginning that this marginalized people, in this case, because they're immigrants and exiled from, you know, the promised land, this marginalized people are experiencing God's blessing, okay, in the midst of their exile, right? Anyway, if we're to, but of course that is considered a great threat to the powers, the dominant powers, which are represented by Pharaoh and his whole entourage, okay? So one of my interests in doing narrative kind of reading and is to, on the one hand, take the text and the details of the text, and lay them out and be clear about them. But then on the other hand, to take our own lives and to try to look at modern contemporary equivalents of say who these different characters and places are. And so I'd like to do that with you now, just fairly quickly, since this is really about the call of Moses. But I think to know Moses' context is important. Okay, so if we look at Egypt in this case represents the system of domination, right? Okay. And then we have the dominated, I guess. Is that an adequate word for them, or is there another word? Here we have the Israelites, who in this case are the vulnerable and the dominated. But also prolific. I mean, you know, the life force is evident in them. Okay, so who are the actors? Who are the participants in this system of domination? Like, if we go through and we look at the characters that all fit under this category, who are they in order of the most powerful going down to the least powerful?
Pharaoh.
Okay, Pharaoh. Who's next? I'll help you here a little bit because you have to read this fairly slowly and carefully. We have Pharaoh's advisors. Okay.
Staff, basically.
What's that?
His staff.
Yeah, exactly. So Pharaoh, his advisors, or staff. And who would be next?
One of the captains of the guard.
Okay, the Israelite overseers, the taskmasters?
We have taskmasters.
Okay, well, what about the Egyptians themselves? Pharaoh refers, I mean, it says, look, they're going to take us over, you know, basically. This people is growing so fast, they're going to take us over. Who's us?
Egyptians.
Okay, it's hard to know. Maybe it's just his power, his system of domination, but it appears to include the Egyptians. Then we have the taskmasters, as someone mentioned. And then we have who?
Well, he attempted to get the midwives, but he wasn't too successful.
Yeah, right. Okay. So the midwives are somewhere here. Well, actually, midwives are Israelites, though, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So if we look at the Israelites now, in terms of the hierarchy, also, who would be the top of the Israelite pyramid?
Maybe a Levite.
Okay. That's definitely somewhere in there. There's a mention of Israelite overseers, aren't there?
Yeah.
Okay. So they would be like the people that were the folks that worked directly with the taskmasters, probably. You know, that had a role in keeping the people, you know, calling the people and organizing them. Okay, the overseers. And we have this family of the Levite, right? The Moses' family. Levite, okay? The mother and the father, the father and the mother. Anyone above them? Where did the midwives fit in? They seem to have a position of power, at least according to Pharaoh, right? So they would be above the family?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think only in this case of the story would the midwives be above the family.
Above the family, yeah, because the father would probably be above them. Shifra, Pua. Okay, what about below the family? I mean, what about within the family? And who else do we have in the family?
Sons.
Well, we have baby daughters. We have Israelite daughters. They're sort of a little higher up than some. Like, who would be the very bottom of the whole pyramid here?
The sons.
The sons, okay. Israelite male child children. Male babies, right? and babies, and so female babies would be above them?
No, in this case.
Anyone else above the female babies? You guys are forgetting one important actress in the story.
Mothers.
The mothers, okay? Is the family of the mothers we have? And then we have the sister. Moses' sister. And then where would Moses be? He'd be a subsection of male babies, okay? So this pretty much shows us a hierarchy of power from the most powerful, you know, to the very least, the male babies. Okay, now if we were to look at our modern society, America, what might be some of the equivalents? I mean, here there's a lot of detail and specific vocabulary to highlight, I mean, to distinguish Pharaoh from advisors, from the Egyptians, from the taskmasters. What would be some of the equivalents of Pharaoh for today?
President and drivers.
Okay. You think they're the ones that are in power?
No, I'm telling you.
Okay. Who are the folks that represent the system of domination in America? Or how about an easier question? Who are the modern equivalents of the overseers, or the Israelites, I mean, who are prolific, vulnerable, dominated? Who might be some of the people that would fit into this category?
Various immigrants.
Okay, immigrants. Did the word prolific make you think of immigrants? Okay, what else?
Impoverished,
okay, so. Okay, brainstorming here, we need some quick equivalents. Who else?
African Americans.
What's that?
African American.
African Americans?
Homeless.
Homeless? It's interesting how it's always the them. What about us? I mean, it's easier to talk about the dominated and the vulnerable and kind of out there, but do any of us fit, are there any equivalencies among our own
kind? HMO members.
Is that HMO members? Okay, that's true. Okay.
It could be workers versus management.
Okay, workers. So management might be up here.
Management or owners, so people are large business.
Okay, management, owners. How about stockholders?
Yeah.
That's the owners, right?
Yeah. And then down would be workers.
Workers.
I put big money above the president.
Okay.
Corporate.
So what? Who's that? The World Bank? The IMF?
Bill Gates of the world.
Yeah. Bill Gates, okay. Big money. Okay. And that could be individuals, corporations, both.
Under workers, Jehovah's Witnesses.
What's that? I'm sorry?
Under workers, Jehovah's Witnesses and people who go door to door and are turned away.
And they're turned away? Okay. So this could be people that are persecuted for their faith. Okay.
Ill and the mentally ill.
Okay, ill and mentally ill.
Addicts.
Addicts, definitely.
Elderly.
Okay, who else? And of course, there's within every single one of these categories, addicts, I mean, there's a whole level of the oppressors and the oppressed. I mean, obviously this is a really superficial overview of just kind of brainstorming. I'm mainly trying to get you to think between them. I'm trying to build some roads between the text and in context, which is something I don't think we do enough of. in Bible study, and I think it's what makes it more fun and more engaging, I think, you know, is to make these bridges. And of course, each one of our lives, we could do this for each one of our lives, you know, looking at our own spiritual autobiographies, trying to find, you know, equivalencies in our own lives to, you know, who the Pharaoh and all these figures are, and, you know, who we are and where we are. And so the Exodus can become, you know, an Exodus for us, maybe, right? Okay, what about, what's that? Prisoners, inmates, okay? How about credit card, people that have credit card debt? How many of you qualify for that? Debtors. Now, what's the average amount of credit card debt? I heard I've read a statistic, $50,000. The average American family has $50,000.
Isn't debtors a choice?
Yes.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, is addiction a choice? I mean, suppose there's a...
No, no.
That's a good question.
What?
Mm-hmm. Do you need a gray area then?
I mean, you know, there was a choice also for... You know, this is a dangerous word, the dominated, right? Because that assumes that they're not a subject at all in their own... They haven't made a choice that's brought them into that place of domination, and I'm not arguing that. That's a completely different issue, really. Although it's interesting, I mean, to look at Jacob's family. Why did they leave to become immigrants? Well, I mean, they had a choice. They could have stayed in Canaan and maybe died from the famine, right?
But Joseph invited them.
Joseph invited them for what reason?
So that his family would live in Egypt with him.
Right, okay. But also so that they could be provided for. He wanted to provide for them because the famine continued in the land, right?
But at the time, it wasn't like they were really immigrants.
They didn't know it was Joseph.
You know, most immigrants in America come for family reunification. So, I mean, the definition of an immigrant, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that Jacob's family came, they were pushed. There were push factors that drove them, just like there are push factors today that drive people, and push factors and pull factors that drive immigration, right? Push factors being poverty, famine, war, things like that, right? And pull factors being work, opportunity, education, you know, so I mean, those things are all in play, I think, in the Genesis story.
Kind of the immigrants would also include the refugees.
Refugees?
Maybe two ways of
okay,
that.
Definitely.
Why you come.
Okay, what about just workers? I mean, people, I guess people already said that. People that have to put in a daily, you know, go to work week after week after week until retirement in order to be able to pay off all the, you know, the mortgage and all the debt. And, I mean, you know, we like to think that we're free. In fact, someone was commenting that, we were commenting in the last study that it's much easier to lead Bible studies in the jail in many ways because the people in the jail recognize themselves as inmates, right? Whereas folks on the outside, people like us, we have a harder time seeing that we're not free and really facing that and confessing it in a way and lamenting it. You know, although many of us do recognize how much we are, you know, we're controlled, we're stuck. Mm-hmm.
I can add homosexuals or
okay,
sexual
definitely.
There. I can also toss in another one that people from Central America, for instance, or other countries where the exploits of America have had an impact, and they're not necessarily part of the country here, but they're. Some people are enslaved by the consumption or the attitudes that Americans have.
Okay, we can put consumers here.
Well, the consumers would be the oppressors.
Providers. Consumers can be the oppressors, but we can be the oppressed too if we're driven by, you know, we have the advertising agent, you know, advertising.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole advertisement industry. You know, that is, and all the big corporations that are promoting their products, you know, we're bombarded by that. I mean, we all have choice in that matter, but we're also being manipulated with very sophisticated means, right, on a daily basis. Whenever we enter any store or turn on the television or the radio, I mean, read the newspaper, we're being hit by, you know, by all kinds of pressures to consume. And we can say, oh yeah, well, we're just free agents, but you know, there's a whole science to, you know, the science of manipulation.
Well, children learn to read advertising logos before they learn to read anything else.
Another category would be the abused.
The abused, absolutely. Okay, and so if we look up here now, we try to fill this out a little bit more. The system of domination?
I think stock market and economic system, because when the stock market turns, there is perceived to turn. Then people are laid off, and then all these other problems intensify.
Okay, so the economic system, and there's all kinds of actors there.
Alan Greenspan.
Alan Greenspan.
Political parties, I think, are.
Okay, political parties.
The church.
Okay, the church can be, because the church, if we look at who these folks are, right, we have all these people going along with it, right? I mean, if we look at a pyramid of actors, we have Pharaoh. But then we have, you know, the advisors, and then we have up down here the Egyptians. You know, the Egyptians are all brought into this system of domination by Pharaoh, right? They're all told to, they're all brought into Pharaoh's scheme to dominate the Israelites. You know, we have the taskmasters. And then we have the Israelite overseers. And so all these folks right here are all being marshaled in, you know, to oppress all the folks underneath here. But there's a huge amount of people in the middle here who are participants, you know, and who are going along with Pharaoh's domination system, right? Those being some of these people that, especially these folks right in here. You know, I mean, here the mothers are even told, you know, the families are supposed to go and throw their own babies into the river, you know, and out of fear of maybe their whole family being killed, right? All right, so let's look quickly at, if we look at, where is God in this story? Is the next question I want to ask. If we look at the Israelite, I mean, this whole schema of the most powerful down to the most vulnerable, the weakest. You know, for the folks that I work with in Skagit County Jail and down in Honduras, most people think that whatever happens to you is God's will. Okay, so the status quo. I mean, if the rich are rich because it's God's will. If you're a poor person, it's because es la voluntad de Dios, you know, it's the will of God. I've tried all my life to make it on my cornfield, but, you know, I don't understand. I mean, it's just getting harder and harder. The markets, I mean, we can't sell our produce, and, you know, and, well, why? What do you make of that? Well, it's the will of God. Okay, so there's a feeling among the dominating, often, that God is the author of everything. So that leads to a fatalism. You know, they have an image of God as all-powerful, an all-powerful sovereign who's way up, far removed, who wills whatever happens. Okay, so God is clearly, since God is all-powerful, God must be in agreement with the system of domination, because otherwise God wouldn't let it continue. And that must be either because the dominated are bad and are being punished, you know, or the dominators are somehow better or good and are being rewarded. This is the whole theology of retribution is the dominant theology on the streets. You know, so many people tell me, you know, God has me in jail. And I say, oh, so how did you end up here? You know, what happened? Tell me about it. You know, well, the police came to my house and they put on the handcuffs and they took me here. Okay, so God is, I mean, the police are God? He said, no, God, the police aren't God. Well, I mean, you just said God has me in jail, right? I mean, you know, people automatically assume without really thinking that whatever happens to them is God. Okay, so, but this story shows us something different. Where, you know the story a little bit. We haven't really gotten to the point in the story yet where things really move, but there is some movement. There is some resistance happening to the forces of domination. Who's that? What the resistance is happening through a number of characters that we're going to look at just briefly. But who are the beneficiaries of the resistance?
The male children.
Okay. So if God is located anywhere in this story, God would be located right here. I mean, God is one of the actors or actresses in this story, right? God is a force that is somehow present, but not very overtly present in this story yet. Okay? So if God is anywhere, God is here. That is a powerful insight or observation that just blows away the people that I work with. What? You know, God is with babies? God is with the weakest in this story? I mean, that's just, what? That's just unheard of. I mean, that's a complete challenge to the dominant theology, the street theology that's out there. Okay, so if God is present, who is God, who does God work through on behalf, you know, what are the, who are the mediators of God's presence in the world in this story? Okay, so the very first are the midwives. Okay, who are the second people?
Mothers.
Okay. Okay, the mothers, although it doesn't really, we don't really know, if, the mothers are all having babies, I guess they really can't, I mean, there's no, they're not deciding which one's a male and which is a female though, right? I mean, are they consciously active participants in resistance yet?
Well, Moses' mother is.
Moses' mother, definitely, okay. Moses' mother? It's interesting, there's very little mention of the father in this story. Who's the third actress or actor?
A sister.
A sister? Okay. And then finally?
Pharaoh's daughter.
Pharaoh's daughter. Okay. So we didn't put her here, but she's definitely up here. Pharaoh's daughter. Her daughter, I'll just put it. Okay. What do all these people have in common?
Females.
They're all females. And who is Pharaoh most threatened by?
Exactly.
So it's kind of like God's doing an end run around Pharaoh's whole system of oppression. You know, God chooses the least expected actresses. I mean, the women, the female actors in this narrative, actresses in this narrative to bring about the liberation. Now, what are the means that God uses? If God is the behind-the-scenes force of liberation working through these mediators, what are the means that God uses for liberation? Like if we were looking at an ethic, trying to find out, well, what are we supposed to do now, okay? Let's look at, we're looking at the sort of the heroines of this story, these four women.
The midwives kind of lied about why they did what they did.
Kind of lied?
So. Why they got using deception then.
Okay, so let's get this ethic. I'm really into ethics. I want to find out a program for the church. What's the first ethic here?
To use the family, to use Moses' immediate family to help save
okay.
him.
Okay, definitely. Now, what did Moses' mother do?
She hid.
Okay, first of all, we have lies. Okay, they lied. I mean, and non-compliance also, right? Okay. I mean, they didn't obey the law. Okay, what's the second? The next one would be, once again, non-compliance. She hit the, but also, specifically, what did the mother do?
She set the daughter
concealed.
Up.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's called concealing the evidence? No, it's not called concealing the evidence, but it's some kind of a crime, right? It's obstruction of justice, definitely. Well, no, not even that. It's worse than that. It's like
conspiracy.
Direct disobedience. It's subversive activity. Conceals, hides, okay? Non-compliance. What else?
It was premeditated.
Premeditated, okay. So all of this is premeditated. What about when she is brought premeditated? Finally, we have someone pointed out in the last Bible study that when Moses' sister runs down and is sort of going along. I mean, she's definitely an accomplice in this whole thing as well. Mm-hmm. And she consciously seems to be withholding information to Pharaoh's daughter about who the nurse maid is going to be, you know. And of course, the mother doesn't volunteer her identity either. So there's kind of a false identity, you know, sort of taking on a false identity, which is a thing that the, you know, immigrants, when they see that in this text, they're just like, wow, we do that all the time. I mean, that's how we got here, right? False green cards and false social security numbers. So, I mean, you have a impersonation, or what would you call that? I know there's something in the law books about what that is exactly. False identity.
There's a conspiracy between Miriam and Bill's mother. A conspiracy first.
Definitely. Conspiracy. Okay, so the reason that I bring all this up is because when we look at Moses' call is it's dangerous just to go and think, okay, Moses is the hero of Exodus. Look, you know, he's the one that leads the people. And so how is the hero called? That's dangerous because we fail to, it's an individualistic way and a heroistic way of reading the Exodus narrative. And for us to even look at our own calls in terms of our own, just our own chronology, our own history, is a very individualistic way of looking at call. You know, according to the Bible, call is part of, my call is preceded by the call of those who preceded me. I mean, of my foremothers and forefathers in the faith. And, you know, and if we looked at our, I don't know how many of you have done this in terms of just looked at your family of origin and studied and looked at, charted your own spiritual autobiography in terms of, you know, the spiritual autobiography of your predecessors, right? Of those who you were able to get information about. But the whole Bible is really about this this people that start out, you know, just very small. I mean, Abram and Sarai, right? And it just branches off. And so everyone's spiritual autobiography is tied to those that preceded them in the story. And so really, if we look at what, you know, what these people did and their particular, how God called them in a way. If we looked at the call of God on the midwives, of course, there isn't an overt call like there might be in some of the overt call texts in the Bible. But, you know, what led them to lie and to be in noncompliance? You know, what about the mother of Moses? You know, I mean, all of these actions are part of the call of Moses and the call out of Egypt, right? And the call, and maybe even our calls. I mean, if we anchor our own faith journeys in the scriptures, Old and New Testament, you know, these stories have something to do with our stories. Okay, I'd like to look more specifically at Moses now. Could someone read chapter 2, verse 11 only? Oh wait, before we read that, one thing we need to note is that Moses, okay, his name means drawn out, taken out, right? Drawn out of the water, okay? So Moses actually, is in this story, ends up becoming totally associated with the system of domination. He's brought into Pharaoh's household. He is adopted into the household of the dominant class, okay, and is raised up in the household of Pharaoh as a son of Pharaoh. Although his origins are in this community of domination and resistance.
He went from the very bottom to the very top.
To the very top, okay.
He's the token Israelite.
So Moses is really a character that many of us can identify with. His status as elevated is someone that makes him a character that we can, you know, that we can see equivalencies in our own lives, many of us. I mean, many of us are children or grandchildren of immigrants who came here with nothing, you know, and some of us have pulled ourselves up by our bootstraps, you know, and we have those stories of success and, you know, kind of coming from nothing up as part of our stories. You know, maybe we didn't start out as members of the dominant culture, you know, but now we find ourselves, you know, closer. We're moving up towards Pharaoh, right? And so Moses is, his story is, it's important to look at for indicators or clues as to how, you know, how does God call Moses? Well, that's important to look at, but we need to look also at how, what that means for me, what that means for you. Could someone read verse 11 of chapter 2?
One day after Moses had grown up, he went out to his people and saw their forced labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his kinsmen.
Okay. What are the verbs here where Moses is the actor, is the subject of three verbs? What are they?
Went out.
He grew up, first of all, right? Okay. And then he went out and he saw. Okay. Now these are three verbs that are really important in the Hebrew Bible and in the book of Exodus, okay? I mean, the idea of going out shows, what does that tell us? I mean, Moses is here, he's part of the system. What did going out mean for Moses? Going out meant going where?
Getting an education.
Okay. You know, there's a lot of study, I mean, a lot of the Jewish rabbinic sources, they speculate about Moses' education. But most of that's really outside the scriptures themselves, about Moses being trained and raised up, you know, with all the arts of, I mean, knowledge of Egypt and everything. It's kind of an assumption that Moses got educated. But in this particular story, what does Moses do when he goes out?
He leaves his comfort zone, for sure.
Right.
His family.
And that definitely is a kind of education, no doubt about it. I mean, you know, when you leave your comfort zone and you go out, I was talking to a man who was at the earlier Bible study who said, I mean, he's a retired guy who's just gone to Central America three times in the last 9 months, or a year, I guess, and it just transformed his life. You know, so going out for him meant, you know, really leaving and going, you know, somewhere very different. I mean, I guess in this case, leaving and going somewhere other, like Nicaragua, Central America. For Moses, it appears to mean something that pretty dramatic, you know, to go out from your place of domination and to come back. It's like he goes back to where he came from. And what does he do?
He kills an Egyptian.
What does he do first? What's the verb that related this third verb that we have?
Saw.
Okay. And seeing leads to a particular action. Now, seeing is not a neutral verb in Exodus at all. What else? Thinking back to the story we just read, where else does see appear in the text? Can you remember?
Where he saw the Egyptian beating the Hebrew.
Okay, definitely. But earlier, before that.
When he was seeing.
The Egyptians saw the Israelites.
Okay. Okay, exactly. That's not the same verb exactly, but Pharaoh looks and he sees. I mean, he looks and he observes that, you know, that the Egyptian Israelites are growing in number. So there's kind of it's like an education. It's an awareness that it's a taking into account. Wow, these immigrants are overrunning this country. Pretty soon we're going to all be speaking Spanish.
Kind of
what's that?
Sounds very temporary.
Yeah. What's the next time?
Daughter saw.
Okay, exactly. Before that, there's another one, though.
The mother sees a baby.
The mother sees the baby. And what does that cause her to do?
Nothing.
Exactly. Okay, she sees that he's a beautiful baby. Okay. And that leads to her decision to hide, right? Now, and then the second occurrence is Pharaoh's daughter who sees the baby. And what does it say about her seeing it?
They saw that it was beautiful,
okay? So, you know, someone was mentioning before about choice and how it's all about choice. Does this appear to be about choice? This kind of seeing?
It's not seeing, but reaction.
More of a reaction almost, right? It's less of a, okay, let's do a study and look at the pros and the cons. Doesn't this feel a lot more spontaneous? Kind of like, I can't help but do this. I mean,
it's paternal instinct.
Yes, it's like it's very deep.
A feeling of love.
Yeah, a feeling of love. It's like there's this awareness of the beauty, right? And an action to save the beauty, I mean, to save the beautiful, that which is beautiful. It's
compassion.
She took pity on
him.
Okay. So this this seeing of Moses. This is the third occurrence where we have C, okay, and it's right in the line of other folks that have seen. So, and of course Moses' action is pretty reactive, right? But it's this seeing that leads to a complete transformation for Moses, and it leads to movement in his life, right? Could someone read verse 11 through 15?
One day after Moses had grown up, he went out to the people and saw their forced labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his kinsfolk. He looked this way and that, and seeing no one, he No one. He killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. He went out the next day. He saw two Hebrews fighting, and he said to the one who was in the wrong, "Why do you strike your fellow Hebrew?" He answered, "Who made you a ruler and judge over us? Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" Then Moses was afraid and thought, "Surely the thing is known." When Pharaoh heard of it, he sought to kill Moses.
Okay. So, seeing in this case leads to what?
Fear.
Okay. It does lead to, well, before fear even.
Action.
It leads to action, right? It leads to this action of murder, of reaction, right? It's interesting that the verb to go out happens twice, right? Moses goes out the first time and sees, and that leads to an action, which brings him back the next day. He goes out again, right? And he sees, as I mentioned, he sees, he saw two Hebrews fighting. Okay, so Moses is on, there's something happening in Moses, right? That seeing is leading to a transformation of his, to actions of solidarity, right? Of course, these actions of solidarity, where do they end up for Moses? Where do they end, where do they land him?
He has to flee.
He has to flee, okay. So
it seemed like the person that helped him must have been his betrayer.
What's that?
The person that helped him must have been his betrayer, not on purpose, but was probably so happy that he was saved, that he must have spread the word to the Hebrews that he was saved by Moses when he killed the Egyptian.
Yeah, that's possible. Or also the people could have just gotten scared to death because they realized here's someone, a do-gooder, coming to help us, but we're going to be in worse problems because no one knows who killed this Egyptian. And so they're probably going to think it's one of us, so the oppression's going to come on us. And here this guy, he's going to be free. He just goes back to his palace. And, the armies are going to come in and wipe us out, right? That's what happens, right? When there's a murder, who gets, people go out and, the police go out and they scour the streets, and who do they end up catching?
They're likely to shoot back.
but they're more likely to target folks that are out there among, that are the people, right? And sometimes it is one of the people that are doing it. And, but maybe it's someone at a different level of a society, right? Who's getting away with it. It's hard to know why the people were upset. But, this is all just pure speculation. But in any case, Moses' first seeing leads to an action that is in a way in keeping with these actions. Lies, non-compliance, concealing, hiding, the premeditated, the conspiracy. But there's one difference. And these are all non-violent actions, right? And now we move to another level of struggle, which is armed, kind of violence, right? And that violence leads to exile. Okay, so what we know about Moses then is that he is guilty of premeditated murder, and that's led to him becoming an enemy of the state. His non-compliance, like the non-compliance of those folks, of course, they all got away with their non-compliance. They were in a way more subversive than Moses. Moses' non-compliance ends up becoming discovered, and so he takes flight. Let's read briefly about what happened. I'm just going to read the one verse, and then if someone could read for us verses 23 through chapter 3, verse 6. Could someone read for us that, 2:23 to 3:6?
Now?
Not now, I'll read the one verse. But Moses fled from Pharaoh. He settled in the land of Midian and sat down by a well. Okay, and there we have it. Once again, it's the women who end up helping Moses, right? It's like Moses is a passive recipient of all this grace, all the way right from the very beginning of his birth, right? And it's the women who are they go home to their dad, and then their dad sends them back. It's not like they're these perfect heroines or anything, but it's interesting. And we're not going to dwell on the role of, this whole story of the Midianites and Jethro, but move on to Moses' call now. Could someone read 23?
After a long time, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned under their slavery and cried out. Out of the slavery, their cry for help rose up to God. God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.
God looked upon the Israelites, and God took notice of them. Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian. He led his flock beyond the wilderness, and he came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of a bush. He looked, and the bush was blazing, yet it was not consumed. Then Moses said, I must turn aside and look at this great sight and see why the bush is not burned up. When the Lord saw that he had turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush.
Okay, stop right there. Actually, yeah. I don't want you to say the next part yet.
Okay.
Okay. So what, one of the things that most of the folks that I read with, they think that, that keeps them from really hearing good news from the Bible is that they have three questions that are always, that are sort of deeply underneath inside of them that they're looking for answers for. Okay, the first question is, what do I have to do to be saved? Okay, there's an assumption that salvation is requires choice and right actions. Okay, so moralism drives the reading of the Bible. You know, the question of the rich young ruler is what drives the readings of most folks around the world, their Bible reading, okay? Ethics. Second question is, what do I have to know? You know, like, what do I have to believe to be saved, okay? Third question, and so we're looking for information, like, do I have to believe this? Do I have to believe this? Do I have to believe that in order to be saved? Do I have to believe all these stories in the Bible and, you know, the virgin birth and all this stuff? Okay, there's the question of what I have to believe, or, you know, what do I have to do, what I have to believe, and the third one is, where do I have to go? Okay,
what's up? What about, what's the point? What's the purpose?
Yeah, what's the purpose? I don't think that's the question that most people ask when they read the text. That's not the most natural thing that people ask. There's more of a concern about security.
So, I thought you were saying these are the three questions that people ask.
I think
in regard to salvation, or
these are the questions that inform or that drive their Bible reading. They're assuming that the Bible is about is wants to give us information about these three levels, right? I think it's a mistake. I think it's
okay.
This is what keeps us from being able to hear good news in the Bible. But one thing that's interesting is that this story, like if we looked at where was Moses, you know, what. Where was Moses in this story when God met him?
The next one.
Okay, where was he?
He was in exile.
Okay, he was in exile.
He was on the run.
He was on the run.
In the wilderness.
He was in the wilderness. Okay, what was he doing? Was he having his quiet time? He was deeply in an ecstatic state of contemplative prayer.
He survived from his father-in-law.
My Bible says that he had just taken the Eucharist and he was singing, you know, worshiping after Vespers.
He was shepherding.
He was shepherding, okay, so he was just doing his job, right?
He was oblivious.
He was oblivious, okay. Now, it's interesting, if we look at the location of Moses in this story, there's some details. It's too bad we're running out of time, but there's some details that are important. How do your Bibles read where did he drive the flocks in this story?
The desert.
Okay, but where in the desert?
West side.
Wilderness.
Okay, the west side of the desert. Any other translations? Beyond the desert?
The far side.
The back side of the desert? Okay. The term in Hebrew is ahad, which means on the other side of or beyond, and can be translated the west. Okay. But what happens in the desert? If we look at the scriptures, what happened in the desert? If we looked at the desert as a place where certain things are likely to happen, can any of you think of that? Thinking about the first, like part of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus. Does anyone know where the first time desert is mentioned? You can't know this; it's too hard. It's Hagar. Okay, Hagar has just been driven away by Sarai, who's jealous because she's become pregnant. Okay, and she finds herself in the wilderness. Okay, the second time is also Hagar, when she and Ishmael are both cast out and they find themselves in the desert and they're dying. Okay, the third time is a mention of Ishmael, who lived in the wilderness, was a wild ass of a man. Okay. The third is Joseph, where he's cast, Reuben said, shed no blood, cast him into this pit here in the wilderness. Okay. So the wilderness is a place of exile and a place where people are driven. They're not there necessarily by their choice. Okay. So first, that's the first point. And there's many other texts that I could show you that show that. Second point is the desert is a place where God shows up. Okay. God meets Hagar, and God meets Ishmael, you know, and God meets Joseph and liberates him through the Midianites and brings him into Egypt. You know, at least later we learn that, right? Other things that the desert, desert functions also as a place of temptation, a place of apostasy, you know, of just rejection, rebellion against God. I mean, desert is always a place of difficulty, of major difficulty. So if we look at where Moses is met by God, we can see that it's a place of utter difficulty. Similar to what, you know, AA or something would say, you know, I mean, in order to really begin the process of recovery, you have to hit bottom. You know, you have to recognize you can't save yourself. Okay. But here what's interesting is that it says it's beyond the desert. Okay. So could what might that mean, you know, or on the other side of the desert?
He's crossed through the desert.
He's crossed through the desert, okay. So could this be a place of you know, that we really can't, I mean, maybe it's like going through your pain or sort of pushing the limits of your depression, you know, going through the darkness, going through the bottoming out, you know?
The only way is up.
Yeah, the only way is up. Okay, so here in this place for Moses, something really important happens. First thing, and we're almost done here, first thing is he sees, okay? He sees the oppression. Okay, second point, second thing that happens to him is that leads to an action, you know? It leads to exile. And the wilderness. Okay, second thing that happens is God is seen. You know, the word Ra'ah, the next occurrence of it after this is God, God appears. And the word appear is actually the passive form of the same verb to see. So, call involves both, you know, maybe in Moses' case, this seeing that leads him on a journey, a spiritual path, right? Where God isn't overtly part of the picture. But a critical part of call is God appearing. And I'm sad that we're out of time, but I'll just go a few seconds more. Appearing in this story happens. What's Moses doing? I mean, he's working, right? I mean, is he pursuing God? Is he seeking after God? I mean, he's oblivious, someone said. And he's at the bottom of the desert, at the end of the desert, in this place where he is clearly not an actor, really. He's a passive beneficiary. Yet, he sees, okay, God appears. How does God appear?
Burning bush.
God appears in a flame in a bush, which is about as close to Moses' reality as you can get. I mean, he's surrounded by bushes, right? And he's probably setting fire and he's cooking every day, right? I mean, a flame in a bush. But this is a flame that is very, very weak in a way. I mean, it's not consuming. And this is approachable. Moses is not afraid. This is a God who comes in a humble, meek way as a flame that doesn't consume. Okay? And Moses, it's a covert, in a way. God comes in the cloak of a flame in a bush. God comes, you know, at meeting Moses right where he is. And it says that when the Lord saw that Moses turned to look, okay, then God said, Moses, Moses, okay? So when Moses begins to pay attention to this, to something he doesn't even know is God, you know, but to God's hidden and gentle and covert way of showing up, that's when God calls him by his name. You know, and I don't know how you're reading this into your own lives, but I think that's an important thing to be doing. You know, how is it that God shows up in our lives? How is it that how what kind of clues does this provide to the way that God shows up? You know, now Moses' first reaction when he realized it was God was, there's three verbs. He was afraid, okay, and he hid, and I mean, when he saw, it's, what does it say exactly? It says, then Moses, God says, come no closer, and then verse 7, God says who he is, and then it says, Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. What does that bring up in your minds, those three verbs? The same three that we talked about before. He saw, looked this way and that. I mean, he saw the oppression, he looked this way and that. He killed the Egyptian and he hid his body in the sand. And then he was afraid when he found out and he ran, okay? So, you know, when we think about why Moses was afraid, it could easily be that Moses was expecting God to be this kind of God that's on the side of the powers and principalities, the God who is up the status quo, you know, the God who's on the side of Pharaoh and not on the side of the weak and the vulnerable, right? Now, just to close really quick, what does God say in response to Moses?
I'll be with you.
Verse 7?
Verse 7. I have seen the misery of my people.
Okay, the Lord said, I have observed. Some of it says, I have indeed seen. You know, the verb in Hebrew, there's two verbs, ra'ah, ra'ah. It's like some Bibles say, I have truly seen, or I have indeed seen. It's like God saying, hey, you've seen, I have seen. Okay? So instead of taking Moses off to, you know, to face the death penalty in Egypt, which is what he was expecting, God says, hey, you know, I've seen. And I've seen the misery of my people. You know, it's like God, Moses has an action of solidarity, and when God shows up, you know, God identifies fully with Moses' seeing, but then pushes Moses into a completely further, another level of action. You know, which is when God says, "I will send you," you know, verse 10. So come, I will send you to the Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. So if we're to look for clues for the way God shows up and the way God acts in this story, just can we throw out a few really quick to close?
Unexpected places.
Unexpected places.
When you're busy, you don't want to be bothered.
Yeah.
Common places.
Common places, right.
When you're complacent.
Okay.
When you're hurting.
When you're hurting. And when God first shows up, is it really obvious that it's God?
No.
Okay. So God might draw your attention to something that is just of interest to you. I mean, you know, that would be very interesting to a shepherd who spent his whole day, all day and night, out in the desert with his sheep, right? A bush that's burning that doesn't get burned up. I mean, it's like maybe that's a way of saying, look, God comes to us right where we are and touches us at our point of interest. And what we really are intrigued by, okay? And then leads us deeper into something more and something unexpected. You know, Moses is, when he finds out it's God, he's expecting punishment. He's expecting this old image of God is right there haunting him, okay? And what does he get? Hey, I have seen, you know, what you've seen. And it's interesting that God ends up doing the same thing Moses does. He ends up killing the firstborn Egyptians, which leads to the whole people having to go out into the desert. And God goes with them. So God takes on that status of fugitive and exile to the extreme, which is all about what the incarnation is, you know, is about. You know, God taking on the sin of the world and being exiled with us to the extreme at great personal risk. Well, tomorrow we're going to talk about sacrifice and whether call requires sacrifice. You know, for some people, call is a very frightening thing because, you know, and we look to a story like Isaac and God's calling of Abraham to sacrifice what's most precious to him. But I think there's ways of reading that text that are where a lot of good news can be heard, and I invite you to come. And if you can read that text before you come, it would be great. Genesis 22, verses 1 until, forget where it ends, but 22.